Podcast.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And we must know who was paying for the coup, who financed the coup, who was involved in that coup, because it's a matter of thousands and thousands of people who were killed. And if we tell the victims no to vengeance, no to retaliation, we have to have the truth about the coup and have justice through the judicial system. This is so simple.
A rare extended conversation with former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide as Haiti calls for the extradition of coup leaders. And we speak to two women on trial in Georgia for protesting the School of the Americas. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives will debate today whether to let Puerto Rico vote to be the 51st state of the Union, remain a U.S. Commonwealth, or become an independent nation. The bill, sponsored by Alaska Republican Don Young, would allow Puerto Rico to decide its political future in a plebiscite. The former Spanish colony became a U.S. territory a century ago after the Spanish-American War. As a Commonwealth of the United States, the island's residents are U.S. citizens, but they don't have a right to vote in U.S. elections. The bill has bipartisan backing, including House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Democratic Minority Leader Richard Gephardt, and the Clinton administration also supports the legislation. But some Republicans aren't happy with the idea of a Spanish-speaking state becoming part of the Union and want to amend the bill, called H.R. 856. An amendment authored by New York Republican Gerald Solomon proposes to make English the only official language of all U.S. states. The bill's supporters said this would discourage Puerto Ricans from voting for statehood. Another controversial amendment, sponsored by New York Democrat Jose Serrano, proposes allowing all Puerto Ricans, whether they live on the island or on the U.S. mainland, to vote in the plebiscite. In this piece from the New York Times, a day after the UN Security Council stopped short of endorsing an explicit military threat against Iraq, the Clinton administration defended its stance that the United States has the authority to use force if Iraq does not comply with United Nations weapons inspections. At the White House yesterday, President Clinton said the council's resolution on Monday night, warning of severest consequences if Saddam Hussein defied the agreement brokered last month by Secretary General Kofi Annan, sent a clear message that Iraq must comply. President Clinton's press secretary, Michael McCurry, was even more explicit, saying severest consequences meant military action. The State Department spokesperson, James Rubin, called the phrase the Security Council's strongest warning so far in the confrontation over inspections of Iraq's weapons. The administration's interpretation, however, put the United States at odds with other members of the Security Council. In speeches on Monday and in interviews with the New York Times, diplomats said they supported the resolution only because it did not call for an automatic military strike if Iraq balked again. Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced yesterday that it had ordered all troops now in the region to begin immediately receiving vaccinations for anthrax, one of the biological agents Iraq is accused of having developed. Secretary of Defense William Cohen had announced late last year that the Pentagon would give the vaccine to all 2.4 million active duty and reserve forces, but he said he decided to speed up the vaccinations for those in the Gulf. Vaccinations have long been a cause of concern for U.S. veterans groups who ask whether they have contributed to the hundreds of thousands of veterans who are suffering from Gulf War illness. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has invited the Iraqi foreign minister to New York to talk about problems with the program that allows Iraq to sell limited quantities of oil to buy food and medicine. Discussions on the oil for food program have normally been conducted in Baghdad by lower-level officials. Annan's willingness to hear out Iraq's many grievances about United Nations programs is a departure from earlier practice when the Security Council, under urging of the United States, sought to isolate Iraq, demanding that Baghdad abide by the rules and not try to change them. The Secretary General, taking a different line, has spoken of the need to not humiliate Iraq, but to draw it back into the community of nations. His comments and in Baghdad and in New York about understanding and respecting the Iraqis are at considerable variance with the more punishing language often used in Washington. This news from Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. Thousands of students protested peacefully against the government today in one of the largest shows of discontent since the onset of Indonesia's economic crisis. Demonstrators at several university campuses urged an end to the dictator Suharto's long rule and better handling of the country's financial predicament. They also appealed for lower prices, which shot up along with unemployment last year after the rupiah plunged in value. In Jakarta, meanwhile, delegates to a special assembly prepared to extend Suharto's tenure. The People's Consultative Assembly, dominated by Suharto supporters, is virtually certain to give him a seventh five-year term next week. This news from London. Maintaining its threat to expel Nigeria, the Commonwealth today urged the African nation to foster democracy by holding elections by October as promised. In a statement, the committee said Nigeria must create a, quote, political environment where the people's right to express their political opinion and to choose a government can be exercised. And that's some of the news at this hour here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The jury trial of five people who protested the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, began this week in Columbus, Georgia federal court. The charges stem from a September act of civil disobedience at the main gate of Fort Benning, where the Pentagon trains Latin American soldiers. A broad coalition of human rights groups, congressional representatives, and peace activists say that the school's graduates are involved in the hemisphere's most heinous human rights violations, and they're demanding it be closed. Indeed, the Latin America press refers to Fort Benning as the School of the Assassins. As part of Women's History Month today on Democracy Now!, we're going to talk with two of the participants in the trial who are charged today, those two people, women. They now face as much as 10 years in prison and $250,000 fine for allegedly destroying government property last September. The verdict is expected to be handed down later today or tomorrow. Their action was followed by a mass arrest in November last year of 600 protesters. We turn now to those two protesters, Sister Marge Ellerman, a Catholic sister from Boonville, Kentucky, a former missionary in Chiapas, Mexico, now working with the rural poor in Kentucky. But first we go to Kathleen Rumpf, who is an advocate for the homeless and former Plowshares prisoner of conscience from Syracuse, New York. Kathleen Rumpf, we speak to you just before you enter the courtroom today. Can you tell us what it is that you were charged for doing in September?
We went to Fort Benning September 29th, and what we really did is to speak truth and to go to a place where the injustice stems from, to literally show up at the gate. And there were two who climbed the trees, the pine trees, 35 feet up in the air, and hung banners between the trees and down the trees. And then the others of us addressed the sign that said, "Welcome to Fort Benning." And we pried off some of the letters and wrote on the sign, "Welcome to Fort Benning, home of School of America, School of Shame. SOA equals torture." We also brought photographs of the Jesuits who were murdered in 1989 and the two churchwomen. And we laid them at the site, laid flowers, and planted crosses with names of people who had been murdered and from the different countries. And they were murdered by those who were graduates of the School of America.
Kathleen, you have gone to prison before, and I was wondering if you can tell us what for, and also tell us a little about your activism in Syracuse, New York. Some listeners may have seen you on 60 Minutes on a profile they did of your protests about conditions in prison, but tell us why you've been in jail before.
I am an activist, and in 1983, I did what's called a plowshare witness, which is basically symbolically hammering, and we poured blood and indicted a chain of command for war crimes. We hammered on the bomb bay doors of a B-52 in the hope of beating swords into plowshares. And we had a six-week trial in federal court. We are accused of sabotage, conspiracy, destruction of government property. We were convicted on all the charges except sabotage, and we received 2- and 3-year sentences. My activism was a result of having been with the homeless for 12 years working and living. And out of my experience with the homeless, I knew where the money was being spent and where it wasn't. And I was trying to address that in court during the Plowshares trial.
And very briefly, your activism around conditions in prison?
5 years ago in Syracuse, New York, I work in jail ministry in a pretrial facility, and I discovered that they were hanging inmates naked, stretched on the bars, and they called it the Jesus Christ. And I am an activist. And
wait, can you explain that again?
Yes. In our pretrial facility, which means people were accused but not convicted for the most part, I found out, because I do work in the jail, that inmates were being hung on the bars naked for the most part. Sometimes they had underwear on, and they were stretched and shackled to their beds and their bars, and they called this procedure the Jesus Christ.
The prison authorities called the procedure the Jesus Christ because they were stretched with their arms outstretched and with their legs outstretched?
Yes, and the deputies, and they would threaten the prisoners and tell them that if they weren't good, they were going to put them in the Jesus Christ. I'll be glad to send you an article about it.
And so what did you do?
Well, I am an activist, and I have been told many times that there are systems in place that I don't need to resort to being civilly disobedient. And I knocked on every door in the city that I could think of, and they literally slammed in my face. So I built a cage, and I lived in it for 7 days in front of the jail with a sign on my cage that said low-income housing. From there, I tried to collect evidence. I found a deputy who had agreed to tell the truth on 60 Minutes, and I also called Physicians for Human Rights, who came in to investigate the procedure. And as a result, 60 Minutes did do a piece called The Jesus Christ.
And as we come round full circle to this action that you are on trial for today in Columbus, Georgia, what are the connections that you see between the various actions you've been involved with, from hammering on military hardware to protesting prison conditions, working for the homeless, and now protesting the School of the Americas?
I'm a person who really strives to make a difference, and if that means getting arrested, so be it. From my experience with working with the homeless, it was very, very shocking to be in New York City in those years and see people literally freezing to death on the streets. Where I lived in New York City on any given day, 36,000 people were homeless in the streets. That's what they admitted to. And I realized that we didn't need to wait for the bombs to drop, that people were literally dying and dropping right in front of me because our priorities are not what they should be as a nation. And more our priorities are in militarism and awful, awful, horrible places like the School of the Americas. And that's the connectedness I have. I strive to speak for those who have no voice in this society and in this world, and try to make visible what's already there. At Fort Benning, we did pour red substance mixed with our own blood, and we tried to make visible the blood that's already there that we refuse to see or respond to.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Kathleen Rumpf. And also, I wanted to send you regards from Father Dan Berrigan. I saw him last night at a mass he gave for the Catholic Worker, and he's sending his good wishes to all of you in Columbus, Georgia.
Oh, thank you so much.
I understand that you're sitting next to Sister Marge Ellerman, who is also on trial today, and I was wondering if we can speak with her.
There you go. Good morning, Amy.
Hello, Sister Marge Ellerman. Can you tell us why it is that you protested the School of the Americas and why you, as a Catholic sister, a former missionary in Chiapas, Mexico, have chosen to face charges up to 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine?
The reason I'm willing to do that is because I am a former missionary from Chiapas, Mexico. I have become more and more aware in these past probably 3 years of the part that our government, and particularly the School of the America, plays in the deaths that are occurring in Chiapas, particularly where I was. And in my own conscience, it's led me to a place where I can no longer simply acknowledge that and not speak out and make that truth known, that the blood that runs in the streets and in the villages and down the mountainside in Chiapas can be traced back to the School of the Americas, and so therefore I am implicated and responsible for what happens there. I take that responsibility very seriously.
How do you know about this connection between the School of the Americas and Fort Benning and the people of Chiapas, Mexico?
Well, the United Nations Truth Commission has repeatedly named people from the School of the Americas who have been implicated in some of the worst atrocities throughout Latin America. And in the recent massacre that took place in Acteal on December 22nd, the commanders in that particular siege were also traced back to the School of the Americas. A lot of my information comes through the School of the Americas Watch.
What has gone on in the trial so far?
Well, at this point, the prosecution as well as the defense have rested their case. This morning we will be going into doing some closing arguments. And then we'll await the verdict. The case, as I see it, has had two sides. One, that the government has repeatedly said that what we have done was to have, in their words, vandalized a sign. But in the defense has spoken very, very clearly that we, in fact, did not vandalize the sign. What we did was use that sign, which is, in a sense, the gate to the school, the gate to Fort Benning, the sign that rests at the very opening to Fort Benning. We use that sign to speak the truth that it's not only the U.S. Army that is based here, but it is the School of the Americas, the school which is bringing great shame to our country. And so we do cut out stencils to say that Fort Benning is also the home of the School of the Americas, a school of shame, and then in a shorter fashion to say that the SOA, or the School of the Americas, equals torture, going back to the release and the admittance in, I believe it was September of 1996, that the School of Americas did, in fact, use training manuals that included torture in them.
Sister Marge Ellerman, is it unusual that this trial of protesters at School of the Americas is a jury trial? Isn't it usually true that the judge, J. Robert Elliott, who's 89 years old, a notorious segregationist judge over the many, many years, isn't it also true that he usually is the judge and jury in these cases?
That has been, I believe, the history, yes. But we are very glad to have a jury this time to be able to listen to not only the factual, but to listen to the intent behind the actions that were taken. And I sincerely believe that any juror who listens clearly to the intent with which we put those letters upon the wall cannot but hear the cry and the pain that is there, and then must open themselves to whatever it is that they respond to in their deepest level to be able to enter a verdict of guilty or not guilty.
Well, Sister Marge Ellerman and Kathleen Rumpf, again, thank you very much for joining us. Sister Marge Ellerman of Boonville, Kentucky, where she works with the poor in eastern Kentucky. She is a Catholic sister and teacher and former missionary in Chiapas, Mexico. Kathleen Rumpf, former Plowshares prisoner of conscience advocate for the homeless. Both of them on trial in Columbus, Georgia, expecting a verdict today in their case as they protested the School of the Americas in September. They join Father Bill Bischel Ed Kinane and Mary Trotashow as defendants in this case. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, a final comment of the judge yesterday in the case. He told people, warned people in the courtroom, we want no more laughter and no more crying. Stay with us.
Wangolo wale kile wavini wemanko wale kile wavini wemanko pei a change kile wavini wemanko wale wangolo Wale Wangolo Wale Kile wavini wemanko Wale Kile wavini wemanko Pays a changé.
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Ever since more than 20,000 U.S. troops swept into Haiti in September of 1994, removing Haiti's military dictatorship and restoring priest-turned-president Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power, the question of justice for the thousands of Haitians tortured and killed during the coup has dominated the political life of the Caribbean country. Indeed, not one major coup figure has been arrested and convicted of a crime committed during the military regime of General Raoul Cedras. Haitian human rights groups say this has been largely due to the extensive protection provided by U.S. and U.N. troops to the former dictators, including death squad leader Emmanuel Constant, who now lives and works freely in New York City. But the Haitian government this week officially asked Panama, Honduras, and the U.S. to extradite 10 leaders of the 1991 military coup and face charges of murder and torture back in Haiti. At the center of the justice battle has been former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who remains the most popular political figure in Haiti. After handing over the reins of power to his successor, René Préval, 2 years ago, Aristide has remained politically active, speaking out on behalf of Haiti's poor majority and building support for an expected presidential run in the year 2000. I got a chance to speak with him in a rare conversation just a few days ago. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. And I'm sitting now in a New York hotel with President Jean-Bertrand Aristide of Haiti. He is the former president of Haiti, has come to the United States for a few days and will be returning to Haiti on Wednesday. First of all, it is an honor to be talking to you today, and welcome to Democracy Now!
It is an honor for me to say hello to you and to all our friends here in the United States.
President Aristide, let me go to the issue of justice in Haiti. Over the three-year period of the coup, thousands of people were killed. We have yet to see in Haiti many prosecutions for those killings. I wanted to start by asking you about the 160,000 documents that U.S. forces took from FRAP, the paramilitary death squad headquarters, and FAD headquarters, the headquarters of the Haitian military, when the U.S. first came in with their occupation forces. They still have not been returned to Haiti. Can you talk about why they're in the basement of the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince and what these documents would mean to the Haitian government?
A, those documents belong to the Haitian people. B, we have to have them back. See, not partly, but totally, all those pages. I am a bit shocked by the fact that we still have to wait for them when we talk about justice. Justice means justice. Our judicial system in Haiti is corrupted. In the past, if you had money, you could get justice. If you had power, you took justice. You gave justice to the one you wanted. Today, we want to build a state of law. How can we build that state of law without justice coming from the judicial system? We've rejected violence, we rejected vengeance, as we rejected impunity. So justice has to be rooted in truth. When, for instance, we know that more than 5,000 people who lost their life during the 3 years following the coup of 1991, and today they still wait for justice. If we tell them no to violence, no to vengeance, no to impunity, so justice is justice. And when they still have the documents of FRAP, they say, in their hands, we know those documents belong to the Haitian people, and they will bring the light of truth to the Haitian people, and we must know who was paying for the coup, who financed the coup, who was involved in that coup, because it's a matter of thousands and thousands of people who were killed. And if we tell the victims no to vengeance, no to retaliation, we have to have the truth about the coup and have justice through the judicial system. This is so simple, which appears, unfortunately, so complicated for some other people.
It came out during the coup through revelations in the Nation magazine that the organization FRAP, the paramilitary organization, was, and Emmanuel Constant, who headed it, was founded with the support of the USDIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. Would you say that the reason they don't want to release the documents is because then we will be able to trace responsibility right to Washington?
Sometimes it's better to not answer for people, to not have judgment of value, when we better describe the reality the way it is. The reality is those documents belong to us. Emmanuel Constant is a criminal. He is involved in so many crimes, and the Haitian people know it. He was in jail here, then released, and the Haitian system, the judicial system in Haiti, is still waiting for Emmanuel Constant to be judged. We know that there are so many others who are involved in the coup. That's clear. It's not a secret for people. Now, if they have hands protecting them, we have to have questions about those hands. Are they also guilty? Are they also involved in those killings? We care for justice. We will continue to work for justice, because without justice, there is no peace, and we want peace. So peace and justice have to be tied.
Freelance journalist Katie Orenstein revealed on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Where Emmanuel Constant is today and what he's doing. Living in Queens, New York, selling MCI cards, continuing to organize. This is a man who headed FRAP. What is happening? Why hasn't he been extradited to Haiti? I mean, here in this country, the president talks about law and order and taking criminals off the street, and yet he walks the streets freely.
I think once we look at Haiti, we see contradictions. When Haitians are pushing for peace and justice, there are some so-called friends talking about peace and justice while they are protecting criminals. That is a big contradiction. But we will not stop. We will continue to work for peace, because without peace, there is no justice, and without justice, there is no peace. It's our responsibility. We will assume it as citizens, not only of Haiti, but of the world, because the world needs peace and justice.
Emmanuel Constant is certainly not the only one. There are other major coup criminals and overall people responsible for mass murder in Haiti. For example, the former dictator Prosper Avril. Under your government, you had attempted to have him arrested, but the U.S. and U.N. forces prevented that from happening, and he made his way to the Colombian embassy, where he was granted political asylum. He now remains in Haiti. What should happen with someone like Prosper Avril, who in this country has a $40 million judgment against him for torture, for brutality?
As I kept saying, it's a contradiction. People talking about justice and peace while they are protecting criminals. on our side, we will continue to do our job, which is working for peace and justice.
Do you think we're going to see many judicial prosecutions in Haiti now? I mean, there are a lot of people even in Haiti that aren't being prosecuted.
Let me open that window. Maybe that will help some people to understand what are we talking about. We had an army of 7,000 soldiers controlling 40% of the national budget in a country where for one soldier we had 1,000 people, but for each 10,000 people we had 1.5 doctors. So the money went to those thugs with uniform. It wasn't an army, it was a group of thugs, and they were leading coup after coup, protecting the interest of those who were financing the coup and exploit the people. How can we say that justice could come to the victims in this environment? The judicial system was created to protect the interest of thugs and people exploiting people, not to provide justice to every single citizen. Fortunately, 2 years ago, we disbanded that so-called army, creating a police force which has to protect the right of every single citizen, rich, poor, whoever you are. Now, we started the process of reforming the judicial system. It's slow, and we have to continue. It's one way to rebuild the country. People who never paid tax because they had that so-called army protecting them, they had internal fiscal amnesty. Since we created that army after that police after disbanding this army, so-called army, we wish slowly but surely we will reform that judicial system, building a state of law where people will have to pay tax and government work for the people and everyone protecting and respecting the rights of everyone else.
Speaking of the new police force, President Aristide, the U.S. spent tens of millions of dollars, brought up the police force to the United States to train them. There are allegations of human rights abuses and corruption, drug smuggling against this police force in Haiti. What are your comments on that?
I think it's a new police force. They make sometimes some mistakes, and we have to say no whenever we see mistakes. They have to improve the way to do things. But by the time they are moving through training, education, to keep protecting the rights of people, clearly you will have hands which we may not see pushing some of them to drugs, to corruption, and to violation of human rights. Because the same hands who were behind the army, they are still there. They are still powerful. And they are not only Haitian hands. There are some other hands, as we saw them behind the army. So it's a heavy responsibility, and we assume it, doing our best to prevent that police to replace the army as an army. The army was involved in drug. Today, they have to clean the police every time they suspect that there are some police who are involved in drugs or corruption.
Can you elaborate more fully on who these forces are behind the Haitian police, those forces that are continue to push for corruption and brutality?
If today we have 85% illiterate people, fortunately they are not dumb, although we are the first black independent country in the world, that means clearly you always had those kind of hands who wanted to exploit a huge majority of the people, because maybe for them they are not people. They are not somebody. They are just slaves. In the mind, that's part of what they have.
President Aristide, there are still about 1,000 UN and UN personnel and U.S. forces in Haiti right now. When President Clinton first ordered the intervention into Haiti, he said it would be a quick intervention with a sure exit strategy, with a deadline for people to leave. But there's still 500 U.S. forces in Haiti. What are your thoughts about that?
I think if we restore democracy to Haiti on October 15, 1994, it was in the framework of the United Nations with the help of the United States. We Haitians people have to continue doing our best to assume the responsibility of providing security to every single citizen, protecting our sovereignty, and work in cooperation with the United Nations, the United States, respecting on both sides the conditions. Now that these people are still there, I wish the respect of conditions will be a fact, a reality, while the Haitian people, we will continue to assume the responsibility, with or without their presence.
I got a chance to attend the event on Saturday night where you spoke to the Haitian community in Brooklyn, New York, which is actually one of the largest Haitian communities outside of Haiti itself. And one of your major themes in your talk was Haiti for the Haitians. At this point, more than half of Haiti's budget comes from international sources. And this brings into focus the whole issue of the International Monetary Fund and the direction it goes versus the direction Haiti wants to go. Can you talk a little about your attitude toward these international monetary institutions, the direction that they're pressing Haiti in, and what you'd like to see for your country?
When they say IMF gives money to countries, many people may understand it's gift. It's not gift. It's a bank. When you go to a bank, you don't receive gift. You negotiate, and if you agree on both sides, you sign, you go ahead. On our case, IMF needs Haiti as the World Bank needs Haiti. It's not because Haiti is the poorest country of the Western Hemisphere that we need them and they don't need us. It's a matter of business here. We need to feed our people. That's one way to protect our dignity. So we have to negotiate the conditions. We don't pretend that we don't need the international community, but we don't want to give up just receiving order. No, we don't receive order. We discuss conditions.
The issue of privatization. Already the cement company has been privatized. There is a lot of discussion about the telephone company, which is the most lucrative. What do you think of that?
This is a chapter of neoliberalism, globalization, and so and so. When globalization promises solutions for the poor, I don't see any country, any poor country, where it's true. I don't see it yet, and nobody can tell me that it exists. Instead, every 3 seconds a child dies in the world because of hunger. Instead, using 1% of what do they spend for military in the world, it would be enough to send all the kids to school all over the world. Instead, and I could go on. So it's to say, we need to create that space where people can listen to the others and discuss and negotiate. I say welcome to those who oppose privatization as to those who are for privatization. Because in a democratic system, we need consensus. We have to be able to create structures to debate and to build consensus.
Do you think that the IMF and the World Bank have the best interests of Haiti at heart?
I do believe, because it's business. They are banks. That means they need Haiti. Haiti is not so poor that some people pretend. Our goal is to have peace, the real peace, peace in our mind, peace in our stomachs. If we just give up, we will never have peace in our stomachs. And once we don't have peace in our stomachs, that means we don't have peace in our mind. And it's not only for Haiti. All over the world today, 1.3 billion people live with less than $1 a day. That means they don't have peace in their stomachs. And how could they have peace in their mind? If we care about human beings, we have to negotiate with whoever pretend helping us.
And we'll return to this conversation with former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in New York for a few days when we come back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with this rare conversation with the former president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, as we sat in his hotel room a few days ago before he returned to Haiti.
What about the corporations that do business in Haiti? In this country, there's a large campaign around Disney, Disney being in Haiti and paying the workers cents an hour, not enough to get by on. Eventually, Disney left, but then has returned. What do you say that these corporations should be doing, and what role can Haiti play in ensuring that they pay Haitians a living wage?
As I kept saying, once it's business, someone will try to get more and more and more. The other one has to understand the games and discuss and negotiate. So we are ready to negotiate with Disney or whatever the company. We think the framework of law, we think the framework of respect for human rights. A worker has the right to defend his rights, and a government has to protect the rights of the worker as the rights of the companies. We think that framework, there is place for discussion, for negotiation.
I remember when you first came into office, swept in to office in 1990 by a vast majority of the population. I don't think anything like that has been seen almost anywhere in the world, that kind of democratic election and the percentage of the vote you got. And when you came into office, you promised that you would, one of the first things you would do is increase the minimum wage. Well, you were soon ousted for a while, for 3 years. But in that time also, the U.S. Agency for International Development came out with a report saying that the minimum wage should not be increased. And we couldn't help here wonder, when you were pushed out by the coup forces, if part of the momentum for that was that you were pressing for companies to pay more money to Haitians. What happens now? What kind of pressure does the U.S. government put on increasing wages in Haiti?
Allow me to answer by putting the focus on the international reality, because many people may not understand what are we talking about sometimes. In 1960, the 20% of the population of the world who had 70% of the richest of the world, today they have 85% of the wealth of the world. In 1960, the 20% who were the poorest of the world, had 2.3% of the wealth of the world. Today, they have only 1.1% of the wealth of the world. So in a world where the poor are becoming poorer, and Haiti, my country, economically speaking, is the poorest country of the Western Hemisphere, how can we accept any kind of conditions? Then it would be a way to go back to colonialism. Then what they call neoliberalism, which is a kind of colonization, economically speaking, would continue to oppress the Haitian people and make us poorer than we are. We don't want that. We want peace for every single citizen, those living in Haiti as those living in the world. That's why we know misery can be a source of violence. And if we are against violence, and we are against violence, we have to work against misery. In Haiti, where we want to move from that misery to poverty with dignity, we will never stop, because we will always continue to respect friends and partners and allies and companies, while we will want everybody, every company, to respect us. We think that framework of respect, there is place for negotiation.
We're talking to former president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who is in the United States for a few days. Are you running for office again?
I'm serving my people as I did when I was a priest, then becoming a candidate and a president, and today still serving my country. It's 12 years ago I started with the kids of the streets. Today, as you have, they also have their own registration. Happy to do that. And I called them this morning. I listened to the radio. It's wonderful to see kids from the streets running their own radio station. 10 years old, 16 years old, 16 years old. They are happy to have that. There are about 400. And to eat every day, to go to school, to cultivate pieces of land as they do. They planted 2,000 trees for the past month, the month of February, and so on. So that's part of my activity. And also, I work with adults through the Aristide Foundation for Democracy, where they have services like credit, 1% as interest monthly instead of 20% elsewhere. They can have food for half or two-thirds price of the market's price. They can have the public transport where they pay half price comparing to what they would pay elsewhere, and so on and so.
This is a microcredit program like on Saturday night when you were talking about the Bangladeshi bank, the Grameen Bank.
Exactly. As you know, I don't want to say the microcredit of Bangladesh is the best, but it's a good experience. They started with $25, and today they have $1,500,000 in their hands every day to loan credits to the poorest women of Bangladesh. And after 18 years of work, 46% of these women cross the line of misery, while only 4%, according to the state area, could cross that same line for that same period of time. In Haiti, in addition to have this microcredit as reference, we also rooted our experience in our faith, so in the gospel, in the Act of the Apostles, chapter 4, verse 32, where it said, all those who believe in God had one heart, and they put in common what they had, and no one was saying that what belongs to him is only for him. Based on that, we have, for instance, a swimming pool where the kids come to swim. It's not enough for 400 kids. We will have to have more. We just started with a new experience where 1,500 young people can learn English, Spanish, and Creole. And they discuss about the salary which they will pay to the teachers and what they would pay as fees. It's not me making decision for them. It's the group making decision because we want to put in common what we have, knowledge, money, and so and so.
I wanted to ask President Aristide about your own safety. Your head of security was assassinated a few weeks ago. What does this mean for you, a man who has had numerous assassination attempts against him, you, over the last, decades, as you became more popular and ultimately were swept into office by Lavalas?
There is different kind of death for me. If I stop loving human being, giving my life for improving the quality of life, it's a kind of death for me. When I try to do my best to serve, I feel that it's life, the real life. That's why I would say each time they attempt to kill me physically or politically, because when they lie through character assassination, it's also a kind of attempt to kill you. They burn our church. They burn the house of the kids twice. Recently, they killed our head of security in addition to so many people we already lost, unfortunately. Those kind of things continue to reflect the same pattern. Killing those who want life, peace. Killing those who really care about human being. And when it happened, I suffer because I'm a human being and I know how the mother of our head of security will continue to suffer as so many friends. But it's so close to us, this reality, that we will suffer while we will never give up. Because for us, as I said, there is different kind of death. If we stop, it's a kind of death in the sense that if I stop giving my life for my people, then I will feel that it's a death.
Do you think killing the head of your security was sending a message to you?
Very clear message. Very clear message.
Who was behind it? Do you know?
The same. When they burned the church while you were praying, when then they burned the houses twice, when then they led the coup, killing thousands of people, they are the same.
If you were to become president of Haiti again in the year 2001, what would be your priority?
We continue to put the focus on peace, as I said. We need peace in our mind as in our stomachs. If we work like that, then it will speed the process of building that state of law.
As we wrap up the interview, I wanted to ask you to, although you have been doing it throughout this discussion, to reflect on how your country has changed from the time that you were a priest in Haiti to the time you became a priest politician and ultimately were able to overthrow the dictators and bring democracy to Haiti through the period of the coup, to the time you returned, agreed that you would only stay in office for one term, though you had not been able to serve the full 5 years of the term, through today and this prospect that you may become president again.
One thing is, now we have a country free from that kind of army I was talking about. It's a major step towards democracy, towards building a state of law. Democracy means, from Greek, demos, the people, kratein, to govern. We cannot pretend that we want democracy if we want to reject the people and not pay attention to their voices. Democracy will not come from the sky. We have to create structures of participation where people can debate, where people can discuss, can have dialogue. And unfortunately, we didn't have that under dictatorship. Now we have it. Free people can talk, and they will continue to use the rights to talk to build that state of law. We don't have any army which can be used to kill people when they talk. They have to talk. And talking while we are creating structures for investing in human beings and promote economic growth, which will benefit all of us, it's a good sign for me, because before we didn't have that. Now we have it. And when I describe it, I would even say this is a kind of irreversible line which we can observe through the process, although it's very fragile. Fragile for all what I said, in terms of having the same hands with violence, killing people, trying to stop the process. So hopefully we will have friends understanding what are we doing and supporting it, instead of friends which are so-called friends.
Is there anything you would like to add to this American audience and people around the world, since Democracy Now! Is also broadcast on the Internet?
One thing I would say is they are lucky to have channels in the media like yours, helping them to listen to different voices, not just a kind of voice. There are some other channels where they will be able to hear the voice of the minority of the minority of the minority, when peace in the world means channels where we can listen to the voice of the majority as the voice of the minority. So for me, it's a pleasure to talk with you, because talking with you, I know it's an opportunity for so many people, good people in the United States, to listen to the voice of the people of Haiti. My last word is, the minority and the majority all together, we will save Haiti as Haitians have to save Haiti.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, speaking with Democracy Now! In a New York hotel room, he returns to Haiti today. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd like to get your reaction to this interview, what Jean-Bertrand Aristide had to say, as we think he's gearing up for a presidential race in the year 2000. Also, to what's going on in Columbus, Georgia, the continued coverage we've been doing of the trial of the School of the Americas protesters. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Coming this week on Democracy Now!, Requiem, a tribute to the photographers who died in Vietnam and Indochina. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Special thanks to KK Kane. Michelle Garcia is our webmaster. Julie Drizin is our executive director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!